Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now is the Democrat candidate for Michigan's 1st Congressional District, Matt Morgan, has joined me. Thanks for coming in the program.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Now, this is our first time able to sit down and really kind of talk about a lot of different things. And I thought it would be a good opportunity. Maybe let's start with getting to know you a little bit. Can you tell the audience, you know, just where you're from? Let's start with there.
Yeah, I currently live in Traverse City with my wife, Angie, and our two sons, who are 7 and 13. I retired from the Marine Corps in 2013 out of Virginia, and we moved back here to raise our boys. Angie grew up in Lawrence and then went to high school in Kalkaska. And, you know, we were married here, and we always knew that this is the place where we wanted to raise our family once I retired from the Marine Corps.
For our UP residents, how much experience do you have, like, coming up here? Did you come up to camp or anything up here during your
Yeah, actually, we have a deer camp that's in the Escanaba State Forest there on the border of Delta and Menominee counties. So okay. Always there at camp in the fall. My 13-year-old is becoming a really avid deer hunter. He actually has done better than me the past two seasons, so...
All right. Your camp's down in the banana belt, but don't let anybody give you a hard time about that one, especially when you're up here when we get our 300 inches of snow.
Right. You know, actually, that's one of the downsides of the past couple seasons is that we haven't had a lot of snow, so not a lot of sign down there. And frankly, it was kind of warm after Thanksgiving this year, a little bit too warm.
Now, what, politically speaking, what's your experience before now?
You know, I've never run for political office. I retired from the Marine Corps in 2013. The plan was to come back here. I was doing some independent consulting and just really wanted to raise the boys here and fish. But you know, the truth was that after the last election, many of us in our community felt like we didn't have a congressional candidate to vote for on either side of the aisle that really had deep roots here, that was raising a family here, you know, that had kids in school or was a member of a church, the type of things that really tie you to a community. And so we began looking for a congressional candidate, and I was asked by some folks in the community if I would be willing to consider it. And Angie and I really thought about it for a day or two, and we came to the conclusion that we couldn't really ask somebody to do this if we weren't willing to do it ourselves.
So was that your driving force between wanting to run for office, just that somebody was needed?
Yeah, we felt that. And I believe, you know, in terms of my Marine Corps experience, I learned from a very early age that leadership is about service. It's about serving those that you lead. And I really feel like too many congressional leaders go to Washington and serve an agenda that isn't necessarily aligned with the interests and the priorities of the people that they ultimately represent. So in running for office, I viewed it as an opportunity to get back into service, albeit not in uniform this time.
You will be going up against the Republican candidate down past the primary when we get to that point in Jack Bergman. And now he, of course, runs on his military record and is very proud of it. This is kind of a different dynamic. I mean, we didn't have this during the last election with Bergman, but now it is kind of like it's not a choice between a military and a non-military. You have two people with similar experiences.
Right. And I think that when you're talking about veterans, you know, there's no single experience that any veteran has. I mean, the era in which you serve, the places that you serve where you have boots on the ground, the roles that you have inside a service, even as Marines, you know, there's differentiations between the occupational fields and the experience a Marine has. So our experience has led us, I guess, to come to very different conclusions about the best way forward for this country.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on your military experience?
Yeah, you know, so I was commissioned in 1993. I first was an infantry officer. My first command experience was a light armored reconnaissance vehicle commander. Had 47 young Marines and 14-ton armored vehicles, and it was the best job I ever had in my life. If I could have stayed a 23-year-old lieutenant forever, I would have done it. But, you know, you got to grow up, and ultimately I had several other staff jobs for the Marine Corps. Began to work as a communication planner and a spokesman, deployed to Iraq for really a total of about 18 months over the course of two deployments. Spent quite a bit of time in the Horn of Africa supporting counterterrorism operations there. Really, the vast majority of my career was shaped heavily by the post 9/11 era. Spent a lot of time overseas during that period, started a family, you know, so all of these things shape the way, you know, I see the world today, both as a military veteran, a combat veteran, and a father.
Okay. Well, before we kind of get into your policy views, let's tackle the primary thing because of the what's this boondoggle that happened with turning in the signatures and then the address, the P.O. box. What happened with all that?
Right. We collected over 1,500 signatures from voters across the 32 counties of this district to be nominated to appear on the primary petition, submitted those petitions to the Secretary of State's office in the beginning of March. We were told everything was fine. In the process of doing that, I signed an affidavit of identity, which lists my home address and the township in which I am currently registered to vote. We were under the impression that everything was set. Then 3 days after the filing deadline, which is 3 days after you would ever have an opportunity to do anything about it, we were told that because the candidate's address on the petitions was listed as a post office box instead of a physical address, that those petitions would not be considered valid. So we're pushing back. Our position is that I am an eligible candidate, and I have submitted the requisite number of signatures from registered Michigan voters to appear on the ballot. To not consider my petitions or those signatures because of something as trivial as a post office box really disenfranchises those several thousand people who have sought to nominate me for the position. Bottom line is, we're continuing to work through it with the Board of Canvassers. We're confident that we'll get a decision out of them on this before the end of the month. Regardless, my perspective on this is simply that we will appear on the ballot in November the same way we always planned on appearing in the ballot in November, which is by winning the primary. If ultimately my name doesn't appear on the ballot, then we're just going to have to educate the people that want to vote for me to go out, write Matt Morgan in, and darken that little circle. And we have every confidence that we're going to be able to win the primary that way.
Does the state have to approve you to be a write-in candidate?
There is a process. You actually have to go down. I have to go back to Lansing, if that is indeed the case, and file another bit of paperwork that says that I am a candidate. I'm a write-in candidate for the primary.
Well, at least you have the advantage that there was not another Democrat running against you for the primary. That I guess somebody could come in as a write-in, but you weren't battling it out with anybody at this point.
That's true. If I appear on the ballot, I will be the only Democrat appearing for the 1st Congressional District in the primary. But if I am not on the ballot, then no one is appearing on that. And so there will be a blank space there where individuals can write in my name and darken the little circle just like you would as if my name was on there.
Okay. Well, you got to know that you're kind of fighting an uphill battle. And just with our recent elections, of course, the last presidential election, Michigan went with Donald Trump. Jack Bergman won the 1st Congressional District fairly easily as a Republican. You're going up against all of that.
Well, of course, but I've been traveling this district for more than a year. And one of the things that I have seen is that the heavy divisive partisanship that characterizes cable news and social media today is exaggerated. If I meet somebody and I talk to them and listen to their concerns and then shake their hand and ask them for their vote, I feel very good that I can earn their vote to do that, which is why we've been working very hard to do it. I think that Michiganders are fiercely independent. Over time, they have gone back and forth between Democrat or Republican. But what's really important is those core values and those things that matter to everybody.
Well, if you make it to Washington, you'll have a vote on some very important things, at least a voice on them. Let's go ahead and start, since you've had some experience with being over in the Middle East, let's start with some of our immigration policies. Michigan, under Rick Snyder, was a state that allowed people to come in, for refugees to come in. Donald Trump has been trying to put a halt on that. If you're in Congress, what will be your views on being able to open up our borders? Let's just start with Middle East.
Well, first of all, as someone who's worked in the Pentagon and a career military officer, I understand the importance of national security. There's no question about that. We need secure borders. In terms of, I really tend to look at the immigration issue largely in the local context. And right here in Michigan's 1st Congressional District, I talk to a lot of farmers who are very concerned about their labor force. And we need to be able to secure a way for them to maintain a legal labor force that is seasonal in order for agricultural purposes. That's really the way I tend to focus on it. When it comes to the broader question of immigration, I think it's really important that we have each of the secretaries that are most responsible for this issue in Homeland Security and defense, and really it's also a diplomatic issue in terms of connecting with our communities overseas, that we have an administration that's really working in consult with the experts within those agencies to be able to develop a coherent immigration plan.
Are we doing enough now to keep dangerous individuals from coming over here that will want to harm the country?
I don't think there's any question that everyone considers national security a priority in terms of protecting our borders against the movement of the terrorists across the border, those who would want to do us ill. The bigger picture for me is, you know, I want to look at it on a day-to-day basis. You know, if you're walking down the street in Houghton, are you really thinking about whether or not you're going to be a victim of a terrorist attack? No, the thing that you're probably more concerned about is whether you can take your kid to the doctor if they get sick, or if you're going to be able to afford your heart medication. You know, those are the things that I hear about when I'm out talking to voters, and I don't get asked about terrorism very much.
Okay, well, before we change the subject, I want to just say one more thing then. For those that are still in this country, like the Dreamers, you know, because that's still going to be a hot topic when after the next election cycle. What can we do, or what should we do, if anything, to preserve their place here, or may give them a legal path to citizenship, or to see that they're moved out?
You know, I see in Congress today broad support for dealing with the Dreamers. It's, you know, generally across America, I think most people believe that that kids who came here through no fault of their own, who have only known this as their home, who don't even speak the language of the country that they came from, need to have the opportunity, need to be protected in that regard. The problem is that the reason this hasn't been addressed, the reason we're still talking about it right now, is because this Congress isn't accomplishing much of anything. The fact is that they had the votes to pass it to deal with the problem last October, but they didn't do anything. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that partisanship is holding votes hostage. And that goes for both sides of the aisle. They're just not getting anything done because the extreme wings of both parties doesn't seem to be willing to let the basically the majority in the middle get anything done.
Well, I think that's well said, Edmund. I would definitely agree with that. All right, well, okay, let's move on to healthcare, since you alluded to that briefly. And under the current administration, there's been some rollback of the Affordable Care Act, some changes in the specifically, I guess, not enforcing as hard as we considered the mandatory having to buy the health insurance, which takes away some funding from the program itself. Okay, if the Democrats were to have a blue wave and win back both houses and have more say in what goes on with that going forward, what would you like to see happen? Or with the Affordable Care Act, does it need changes, or does it need to be enforced more as it is?
I think everybody agrees that we need to fix healthcare. The concern that I have coming out of this Congress is that the House voted three times for a bill that would have taken healthcare away from more than 45,000 people in this congressional district. And in Houghton County alone, we've got almost 2,500 people covered under the Healthy Michigan Plan. And they would have, had that bill been passed, had it gotten through the Senate, they would have lost their health care. And this is really critical to rural hospitals, particularly, you know, right here within the Aspirus community in Keweenaw and Otonagan. You know, these hospitals rely upon the money that comes to them through Medicaid and Medicare in order to be able to continue to operate. In addition to that, they rely on federal drug discount programs so that they can provide services to the affected community. You know, really, in most of these hospitals, when you go out and talk to the administrators, a quarter, you know, 25% of their overall costs are on pharmaceuticals alone. So if they can't discount their drugs, if they're not eligible for that, you could see hospitals like Keweenaw close as a consequence. At a minimum, their services would be severely crippled, where you would be able to, you might perhaps see maternity services shut down at one or both of those hospitals.
Sticking with healthcare, let's talk about veterans care. Now, how closely do you watch Bergman? Because he's on those committees. He's dealing with, like, the problems with the VA, and he's addressing veterans issues. Now, with somebody with a military background, you might be able to calm some of those who vote Republican because they want to make sure that veterans are taken care of. So what would you do differently or the same if you get the office?
Yeah, veterans care is really important, particularly in this district where about 1 in 10 residents is a veteran. If you rely on the VA for your health care, I don't believe you should have to drive 60, 70, 110 miles. You shouldn't have to go to Iron Mountain if you're up here in the Keweenaw. And if you're in the lower peninsula, you shouldn't have to drive down to Saginaw to get quality health care. I firmly believe that privatization of the VA health system is not the way to go. Introducing for-profit interests into that will only lengthen and complicate the access to health care that our veterans need. I think that if you have Medicaid, for example, or Healthy Michigan, or Medicare, and you can walk into a hospital and receive health care, there's no reason on earth that a disabled veteran shouldn't have the same privilege and the same access.
The MO4, both Jack Bergman and his predecessor, Dan Benishek, has been sort of trying to crack down on the VA. And that's always been sort of the way they've approached it, that they've got to fix the VA. When you look at the VA, do you see a big problem, or do you see that, you know, are they characterizing it that correctly when they have to go in there and fix it and root out a lot of problems?
I don't believe that's the best approach to the VA because, you know, my personal experience with veterans health care has been very positive, but I know others who have very challenging experiences in that regard. So it has to be, you have to look at it as not just a systemic issue, but, you know, an isolated issues and where you can fix them, because it works well in some places, it needs to work better in others. Traumatic brain injury research, for example, looking at behavioral health issues. The VA is very good at that, and we need to continue to allow them to do it. Organizations like the American Legion and AMVETS have been very supportive of the efforts that the VA is making and towards reform. The answer to quote-unquote fixing the VA is not privatizing it. It is not introducing a for-profit interest into this, because we've seen what happens when for-profit interests get involved in these types of basic services. I saw it in Iraq firsthand when our logistics tail was privatized and handed over to an organization that was, you know, making money by hiring foreign nationals to come in and do our laundry. So I do not think that is the right approach to this. Most folks, I think, would agree that privatizing the VA is moving in the wrong direction.
Okay. I'm going to throw a flaming football in your lap, okay? A couple of months ago, I had three students here from one of the local high schools. It was shortly after the Parkland, Florida shooting. And they were doing their local demonstration, part of the national movement, about trying to end gun violence in schools. And they were I found them to be very intelligent, very well-informed, and that was their goal. They wanted to end gun violence in schools. They wanted to stop kids from getting shot in schools. It wasn't their agenda when they sat here wasn't to take people's guns away. They just wanted to try to find a solution so that they didn't have to be afraid to go to school as far as being gunned down while they're in a classroom. I warned them that their biggest danger is that in a couple of months, people are going to move on. They're going to find something else to worry about, and we're going to backburner this until the next shooting happens. It's going to be, I think, up to a Congress coming up soon to actually address something and come up with some sort of solution, that flaming football that nobody wants in their lap. Somebody's going to have to run with it. What can we do?
Well, first, I want to say that I think that seeing students actively engaged in political activism is a very good thing. Having more young people given a reason to go out to vote is great. I'm also, as an individual, I believe the Second Amendment defines an individual right to keep and bear arms. So we have to consider those things in terms of my approach to this, and that ultimately is that there is no single solution. There's no push button that's gonna fix this problem. It's comprehensive, it's complex, and step one is that we have to be willing to have a coherent conversation about the issue at hand. And too often it becomes highly polarized. People get extremely emotional about the issue, and you can understand that because, I look at it this way. I'm a combat veteran. I have a lifetime of experience really with the AR platform. I mean, I probably have four or five years of my life literally sleeping with that rifle. I'm also a gun owner. I'm a hunter. I'm a handgun owner and a CPL holder. I'm also a parent. And like any parent, you send your kids off to school, you put them on the bus in the morning, and you expect them to come home safe at night. And so that ultimately is the question that we have to address. Congressional action, there's certainly a role there. I would say that we need to definitely be looking at what some states are doing. You know, obviously some states are doing better than others, and so we need to know. The state of Michigan has been blessed. We seem to be doing relatively well here, and so I'd like to be able to look at what those states are doing and try to repeat that success in Congress.
Well, I'm going to push it a little further. Okay, what about providing armed people in schools, or allowing certain teachers to be able to have the option for carrying firearms? Because I pose that same question to those students, so I think it's fair to pose it to you.
Yeah, So my father-in-law was a Marine. He fought in Vietnam in 1965 and 66. He came back. He worked as a primary marksmanship instructor at Parris Island. Then he came back to Michigan. He went used his GI Bill at Central Michigan, became a teacher. A few years after that, he was hired. His first job as a principal was right here in Lawrence. He was the principal there for many years. He spent well over 20 years as a high school principal, hunter, firearms owner. In my view, there's no better person on earth that you would trust with a firearm, and he will tell you that there is absolutely no reason for a teacher or administrator in a public school to be armed. It's ultimately not the solution. Me personally, I've cleared buildings in combat. It is an experience that no one who's ever done it will forget. You know, your heart's beating 3 feet outside of your chest, your hearing is reduced because your brain is shutting it down, you get tunnel vision. And so the idea of clearing a building or finding an active shooter under the best of circumstances is extremely challenging and requires a great deal of training. And I don't think anybody who's ever been in that position necessarily feels like they've had all the training they need to do it. And the idea of introducing 600 school children to that scenario is not something that I would be confident in dealing with, nor do I think that we should add that to the, you know, to a teacher's plate and expect them to be good or proficient at that.
Okay. Well, let's pull our last topic right off today's headlines. Okay. Just within the last few days of recording this, our administration has decided to pull out of an agreement, whether I've heard a lot of argument whether or not it counts as a treaty, but it's with Iran, with the nuclear deal. Your thoughts on whether or not that arrangement put in place by the Obama administration was a good one, and whether or not we should have maintained it, or do you agree with us pulling out of it?
That agreement that was negotiated by the Obama administration was not perfect. But to be honest, diplomacy seldom is. Diplomacy requires building relationships over time. And even if the relationship or the agreement that we had in place with Iran wasn't perfect, it was working to a degree. A lot of the benefit in it had been front-loaded toward Iran, so they had already received the level of benefit. We were getting inspections and oversight. I would say that I agree with Secretary Mattis and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joe Dunford, that the agreement was working, although not perfect, and should have been honored. Breaking that agreement, backing out of a multilateral agreement, has created a great deal of risk for us at this time. We've seen the way Iran is reacting. They're not a rational actor. And, you know, treating rational actors as if they are, is, or irrational actors as if they are rational, can be a dangerous thing to do. I also feel that it can be, you know, we're on a track right now, and we would give the president credit for the fact that things seem to be moving forward with North Korea in a way that is, you know, positive. I'm cautiously optimistic about where that is heading. But to break our agreement, this multilateral agreement with our European partners and Iran now at this time, I think it sends the wrong signal to North Korea.
Well, what was the benefit for us with that Iran deal? Because that's one thing that I don't see a lot put forward. I said, well, this is why it was good for us. I mean, I see a lot of benefit. You're right. A lot of it's front-loaded for Iran because I've seen a lot of their benefits. I didn't see much coming back our way.
The greatest risk in the Middle East and to our allies in Israel and across the Middle East, the greatest risk is a nuclear-capable Iran. We have to be working toward the objective of restricting them from developing those weapons. We have seen what happens when we don't have access to and the opportunity to have inspections, and that is why the Republic of North Korea is nuclear capable today, because they were allowed to develop those weapons because we didn't have the ability to inspect and provide oversight and be there observing them. People can always cheat on deals, but I'll tell you, it was going to be a lot easier for us to detect their malign activity if we were there and present. So it's very important that we be able to maintain these relationships. And I think that was an extremely damaging and rash decision.
Now, for our kind of closing mini here, I'm going to have a lot of my audience who say, "Oh, why didn't I get into Russian collusion and all that sort of stuff with you?" And it's like, well, I don't want to get into all that. You're going to have to deal with that.
You know, the when fact you get is, there. most voters don't care about that. I don't get asked about that. I mean, the fact is, there's an ongoing investigation. I'm a Marine. I believe in the rule of law. Most Americans believe in, and certainly up here, respect and trust law enforcement. Let's let that process work out, and when we have a conclusion, we'll deal with it. But speculating about it right now is not positive. The fact is you've got too many families in northern Michigan who get to the end of the month, they got $300 worth of bills on the kitchen table and $50 in the checking account. Those are the real and acute problems that face working families here today.
All right. That actually kind of just about answers my last question as well. Well, when you do that there, what will be important to you? And that sounds like it's pretty important stuff. People want to be able to follow your campaign and learn a little more about you. How can they do that?
MattMorganForMichigan.com. That's F-O-R spelled out. They can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. We're always out moving in the district. And, I've been on the road for a little over a week from St. Ignace up here to the Keweenaw, and I'm going to be headed back down to the lower on Sunday morning. Facebook is really one of the great ways to follow what we're doing. And, MattMorganForMichigan.com is a place to learn a little about who I am and what I stand for.
Matt, I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.